Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century. In the following program, Jamie Metzl, non-resident senior fellow for technology and national security at the Atlantic Council, speaks about flaws in the Chinese reform process at the China-U.S. Business Alliance in New York.
My sincere pleasure to be here speaking with all of you about really one of my favorite topics, which is trying to make sense of this miraculous, glorious, perplexing, challenging issue, which is the rise, or perhaps more appropriately, the rebirth of China. And China is so big and so vast and so complex that perhaps it's only knowable collaboratively. No matter who you are, and there are some people in this room who are tremendous experts in China, nobody can get our arms alone around China to even begin to understand what's going. And so I present my views today as one view, but as part of a collaborative process of working all together and coming together repeatedly to best understand and make sense of what's going on in China. And for any of us when we speak, but certainly for me, there's always an element of theology, that we come with our own personal biases and we can see the same pieces of information, and some of us interpret it one way and others interpret it differently. And when I was thinking about this topic of reform and governance, I thought of two sayings involving cats, one from China and one from the United States. From China, of course, there's the famous saying by Deng, which is essentially white cat, black cat, it doesn't matter as long as it catches mice. And from the West, we have the saying, there are many ways to skin a cat. You would think that China was a more friendly place for cats, but I'm not sure that's true. But it's clear that there are some cats who don't catch any mice, and there are some ways of skinning cats that are maybe markedly better or more sustainable than other ways of skinning cats, although don't try this at home. And so my just very, very simple point, and this is if anybody wants to check your messages, you can just listen to this point, and then you can check your messages, and if somebody asks you afterwards what was the talk about, just repeat this and you're good. But my very simple point is that no matter how serious Xi Jinping and company are about reform, top-down reform, which is what's happening now, cannot work and will not work unless it is accompanied at some point by political reform. That point doesn't need to be right now. It needs to be layered in. But it cannot work and it will not work unless accompanied by political reform. So let me take just a quick step back. I believe that there are three essential drivers of the legitimacy of the Chinese government. One is its connection to Mao and the revolution. Two is being a champion of nationalism, Chinese nationalism. And three, and most importantly, is as a driver of economic growth. And the first, in terms of connection to Mao, Deng himself said Mao was 70% right and 30% wrong. But there's a reason why Deng's picture is on Tiananmen Square, even though by many accounts, Deng is responsible for more deaths than Hitler. And the reason is because the legitimacy of China's government is connected to that experience of the revolution. But if that was the only source of legitimacy for the Chinese government, China would be in big, big problems. There would be a real challenge of legitimacy. The second issue is nationalism, and that is China in the first years after the revolution, really until Tiananmen. The main story, the narrative of the party was that it was about internal class revolution within China. But after Tiananmen, when the party and the government realized that they had lost control over this narrative of nationalism, they have now positioned themselves as champions of nationalism. And although there are many historical and other drivers, one of the reasons why we're seeing such an aggressive expression of nationalism and an allowance for expressions of nationalism within China, because there are lots of people in a free and open ideas environment who would talk about Xinjiang and Tibet, and those people aren't allowed to speak, but you are allowed to speak if you're promoting extreme nationalism. But most importantly, the most important legitimator of the government is its ability to deliver economic growth. And it's been an absolutely remarkable, you all know the story, it's been absolutely remarkable decades of growth. And that's a very significant legitimator. But right now, after more than three decades of 10%+ growth, China's growth story is decelerating. And you all know the numbers. GDP is slowing, and it's probably slowing more quickly than the official numbers indicate. Manufacturing is down, productivity is down. As a continued effort to increase stimulus, debt is up significantly. And part of this is a planned slowing. The Chinese government recognizes the dangers of overheating. But part of it is a recognition that China is slowing. I cut my hair short because I'm losing my hair, even though it's my strategy to cut my hair short. And so I think that there's a push and a pull for what's happening with China today. And the government is facing a difficult balance between reform and stimulus. And there are these two poles because the party and the government must maintain growth for legitimacy, but it needs to slow growth for sustainability. And we see this always because when bad numbers come in, then we'll see these more stimulative measures that are taken, even though sometimes those can cut against the reform, which is in China's long-term interests. And there are structural reasons for this deceleration. So some of them are kind of less immediately controllable: the aging population, the slowing export markets outside of China, and possibly even rising wages. I mean, that those are all probably inevitable based on at least where China is. And then there are the issues that control economies, which China is no longer, but it's coming from being a control economy, are more conducive to rapid early stage growth than they are unless they transform to later stage kind of growth through consumption and particularly innovation. And even the Soviet Union in its early phase of growth actually did a very good job. North Korea, the Soviet Union, the people in the United States were saying, how can we compete with these guys? North Korea, in the early stages, people in the South were saying, how can we compete with these guys? But history has proven, I think Chinese leaders recognize this better than anybody, that a control economy can't become a truly modern economy. But critically, and this is a very, very important point, is that the political centralization of the party through the vehicle of the party distorts every aspect of China's economy. On the one hand, it's on what that this centralization is what helped China with the first phase of its growth, but the exact same centralization that was critical in phase one is an active detriment. As a matter of fact, in my view, is an absolute impediment to being truly successful in phase two. And because of this over-centralization, or because of this centralization that made sense in an early stage of development but makes less sense now and makes no sense in the future, virtually all resources in China are misallocated and misused. And that includes access to land, property, capital, opportunity more generally. The pollution issue is about misallocation of political power because the state-owned enterprises have a right to pollute, but the people whose air and water is being poisoned don't have a right to stand up to that pollution. And we're seeing that through the wealth disparities and the income disparities in China. And you only need to look at the economic background of the people who are in at various stages of the Chinese government. The higher you get, the richer you get. And that's not an accident. And there is a taxation of this over-centralization because the capital that's going to state-owned enterprises is not going to small and medium enterprises. So there's this system has a tax. And as China's leaders themselves understand, this is not sustainable. But this misallocation is ultimately, however, not an economic issue. It feels like an economic issue, it looks like an economic issue, and China's responding to it as an economic issue, but at its core, it's a political issue. And the political issue exists because there is a core problem, and the core problem is that the party itself is a patronage vehicle. Like, if you said that everybody in the party was going to make some minimum wage, or there was a cap, let's just say $50,000, and that anybody who made more than $50,000 who was in government would be imprisoned. And let's just say that was enforced. What would happen to the Chinese Communist Party? The party itself, maybe once it was something else, but now it is a patronage vehicle. And if that is true, as I believe, and again, there are many different views here, and there are many different ways to quote-unquote skin this cat, corruption is not a cancer on the system. Corruption is the system itself. When we think about what does an anti-corruption campaign look like when corruption is the system itself, that looks much more fundamental than people are talking about now. But China's leaders certainly understand the economic challenges that China faces, probably more than anybody else. And even non-leaders are understanding these challenges, and that's why Jeff was talking about all these efforts that people are trying to get their money out of China, and they're buying all the real estate out here, and they're sending their kids here, and they're coming here to have babies. So the Xi Jinping strategy, it appears to be, is first to have political centralization in order to be able to drive these economic reforms. And certainly, Xi is certainly the most powerful Chinese leader since probably Deng, but some are even saying since Mao. And there have been stages in the third plenum and fourth plenum and elsewhere where very significant reforms agendas have been announced. In the third plenum in 2013, with the greater reliance on market forces, the fourth plenum, 2014, a more predictable legal system, efforts to boost consumption, efforts to shift the revenue base for the provinces from land sales to bond issues and taxes, state-owned enterprise reform, new reform for mixed ownership, at least of new businesses created under the SOEs. And even last week, the government announced a reduction of large SOEs from 112 to 40. So these are all very real efforts to reform China's economic system. And I think that they are certainly well-intended based on a certain view of how China works and how the world works that may, in fact, be right. But certainly, at least so far, there's been, although the reform effort is sincere, there's been uneven implementation. And nobody, certainly not I, can understand what the roadmap is, like what all the stages of the reform process are. But I certainly, just from the viewpoint of now, would say it's real and it's sincere and it's well-intended within the limitations of the system. But there are structural reasons why these reforms are and will continue to be extremely difficult. First, the skill set for the manufacturing export model is different than the skill set for an innovation and consumption model. And the shift from one model to another while maintaining growth, because as I mentioned before, Chinese leaders need to maintain this growth for their own legitimacy, is extremely, extremely difficult, especially in the face of headwinds. It's equivalent to refitting your airplane while in flight. I mean, these China's leaders are extremely skilled and brilliant, but this is a certainly tall order, especially when there are headwinds coming from the rest of the world. And it requires overcoming very powerful vested interests. And there's a push and pull of this issue because the state-owned enterprises, on one hand, are part of the problem because they're monopolizing power and influence and all those things. On the other hand, state-owned enterprises are part of the government's dominance, at least, of certain strategic points in the economy. They're part of the patronage because people get access to these kinds of jobs and this kind of power. So it's not as simple as we can just overcome these vested interests because the party itself is the most important of the vested interests. And so this anti-corruption campaign, in my view, can be seen as an effort to overpower the vested interests, but while maintaining the centrality of the party and maintaining the role of the party as being above the law. But the question then is, even if this top-down approach is meaningful and well-intended, can it work? Can the party simultaneously be both the problem and the solution? And when we need to think about this question, we need to look at elsewhere in Asia. where people have tried and have thought about these kinds of transitions from single-party states to multi-party states. And everybody talks about Singapore. My friend Elizabeth Economy talks about the China model as kind of a Singapore on steroids. But I spend a lot of time in Singapore, and Singapore is actually a pretty open, relatively open, certainly relative to China, society. I mean, they had their opposition parties, they had won 40% of the electorate in the most recent election. They didn't get 40% of the seats. They got about 7% of the seats, but the government sure heard them. Yes, there are these high-profile defamation cases, but there's a lot of free speech that people have access to. So if China were to follow a Singapore model, that would be great, and maybe that would be an answer for China. But there's a lot of opening that would happen between now and when China could follow a Singapore model. And then Korea, which started out as a single-party state, not from the communist background, but from the military dictatorship, and they laid the foundations in that, in the first Park regime, they laid the foundations of the industrial policy, actually with a lot of help from the United States. But when democratization happened, that was when Korea had its big growth, its real economic growth, when it really became a modern society, was after and not before democratization. And so there's not a real analog for China. In fact, there's no non-oil state example of an authoritarian state that has become a high-income state. And that's... China is such a remarkable place with such remarkable people that I would certainly, if anybody was going to do anything once, I would bet on the Chinese. But this is certainly a tall order. So the question is, if top down at least isn't proven, what can you add to top down? And this is not a trick question, because the answer is, as Charles knows, the answer is bottom up. And so the question is, what would it look like? I mean, how could China have a bottom-up reform that would empower the people who are getting the short end of the stick to advocate for themselves, rather than empower the people who are getting the long end of the stick to stand up for the people who are getting the short end of the stick, which is, at least from an American perspective, against human nature as understood by our founding fathers here. But unfortunately, there's no evidence of bottom-up. In the last regime under Who and when the Three Gorges Dam, under Three Gorges Dam Project, or after the Sichuan earthquake, there was when the people said after the Sichuan earthquake, we have this terrible building and our children are dead, those people were silenced. After Three Gorges Dam, the people who protested, who said that our livelihoods have been taken away, those people were silenced. And under this regime, under Xi, although there's this talk of reform, there's, as you all know, an incredible crackdown on alternate voices, on media, academia, civil society, speech, free speech, minorities. They're really all of the space for bottom-up advocacy has been squashed. And you may have heard of the Central Committee Document Number 9, 2013, where it was an order that went out to the party to make sure that people weren't talking about issues like universal values, constitutional democracy, free press, civil society, etc. And so there's a real contradiction here between the fourth plenum calling for constitutionalism as a way of enhancing rule of law, and yet people who advocate for constitutionalism being arrested. There's a real contradiction between saying we have a corruption problem and we need to face it head on, and when the little guys who are harmed the most by the corruption, when they go out and protest, those people are put in jail. And my thesis, I mean, which I've already said, so hopefully it's clear by now, is that Xi is betting the future of China on a top-down reform approach that ultimately can't work. China's society is simply too complex. It's too big. There are too many things happening for a top-down approach to work. And there are some people who say, well, what about intra-party democracy? There's 90 million members of the Chinese Communist Party. That's more people than vote in most countries in the world. What about just having intra-party democracy as a proxy? But again, because the people in the party are by definition more advantaged than everybody else, even that, it may spread the wealth a little bit more at the top, but it's not going to address the kinds of imbalances that I've been speaking about. And when you think about it, in spite of the anti-corruption campaign, well, is it working? Certainly, you've all heard of all of these investigations and the arrests and all of the high-profile events. And I know that we had somebody, at least on the list, from Dolly and Wanda. Maybe they're not here yet, but I'm sure everybody read the article in the New York Times last week about Dolly and Wanda. And so if you're some little guy and some provincial official and you want to go to dinner and you want to have 5 dishes and 2 soups, and someone says, no, you can only have 4 and 1 soup, and then you learn about the stock structure of Dolly and Wanda, where the family of Wen Jiabao and Xi Jinping and all these other high-level people are making hundreds of millions of dollars, you're probably thinking, well, I'm just a fool. I'm going to get my second soup, or I'm going to wait until the guard is down, because if the guys on the top are all billionaires, like, why is it fair that I don't get my second soup, or I can't get this watch for Chinese New Year? And so if that is the attitude, it's going to take a lot of force from the top down to keep everybody in line until the people on the top start policing themselves, not just in terms of public appearance, but in reality. It's going to make it very, very difficult for the anti-corruption campaign to work. But I believe that the anti-corruption campaign isn't even about corruption. It's about the appearance of corruption. It's about the theater of corruption. And it's about the government not wanting to have people's nose rubbed into the corruption that they're facing every day. But in a system, as I mentioned before, where corruption is the system itself, where if you took away the entire profit motive, and that every single person who was a member of the, again, as I said before, a member of the party who was working for the government could only make a maximum of $50,000 a year, and you enforce that every other person would go to jail and there was no way around it, it would have a significant negative impact on governance in China, because it's the nature of a patronage system. And so what Xi Jinping is doing, what he's betting the house on, is that there can be a reform of the nature of the people who are in power in China today. So of the people who are already in control, you can get better behavior from them, and that is going to address these underlying challenges of the Chinese economy, the Chinese society, culture. But it's not enough to change the culture of leadership. They have to transform the institutions of governance to deliver structural accountability. Because if it's about goodwill, goodwill can't last forever. If it's just that the people in power need to have goodwill and then the people who are not in power will benefit, I just don't think that's a good enough foundation or a strong enough foundation for a sustainable society. So what would accountability look like? And this is not a surprise. But the person who I really appreciate and value is the great Chinese journalist Tu Shu Li at Tsai Chin, and I agree with her. It's rule of law over the party. Like, you can't have rule of law and then the party above the rule of law. That's not the rule of law. That's the rule of the party. And independent judges, independent courts, disclosure, asset disclosure, sunshine policy, freer media, letting civil society advocate. And again, these are all things where China is doing some of these things, but not enough to address the structural imbalance. And it's only by empowering the people who are getting the short end of the stick to fight for their own rights and interests that these distortions can be held at bay. And this reform doesn't have to be all at once, and China may choose not to do it at all. And this may be, as I mentioned in the beginning, this may just be a theological bias of a person who grew up in the United States and knows governance as being one way. So all I can do is speak from my own perspective with the best of my ability and the best of my analysis. And China has some options. It could be that, as I mentioned before, that a Singapore model might work. I think Singapore, for a tiny little state of a few million people, it's kind of a proven system. It's a stable society. It's much more difficult to do it with more than a billion people, but let's just say that that was one of the avenues. Well, China could do that. They could open up as much as Singapore is open, and that would be a huge amount of opening. And then you'd say, all right, well, there's this one little model of how this reform process can work. And it may well be, I mean, I have no idea what's in Xi Jinping's mind. It may well be that this is all a strategy and it's all been mapped out, and the strategy is centralization and then economic reform to lay the foundation for a stable future. And once that is achieved, and once there is this centralization, then using that momentum to drive political reform. So that could well be, but I, for one, haven't seen any evidence yet, at least, that that is the current strategy. But if China's strategy is what it appears to be today, of top-down economic reform without meaningful political reform that places the party under the rule of law and empowers people to look after their own interests, then Xi's reforms cannot, and over time at least, will not work. And perhaps it might work. I mean, one model could be, I mean, certainly the generals in Korea didn't want democratization, but at the last possible minute, they faced a choice, which was opening up or collapse or chaos, and they chose opening up. So it could be that the party, it maybe likely will be, that the party will hold on until there's no other choice, and then they'll be opening up. And that could be, and that certainly worked well in Korea, but nobody knows how much time China has. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, there are all kinds of stories of bubbles, and certainly the stock market today very much feels like a bubble. The debt is being transferred into equity, and the justification for these extremely high valuations is based on a future growth story, which again pulls the government more onto the side of stimulus at the expense of reform. But there are lots of things that feel bubbly in China. So maybe China has a lot of time to manage this kind of process. Maybe it doesn't. We really don't know. But one thing that I feel confident of is that the political misallocations of power will likely only exacerbate China's economic problems. And that inversely, addressing the political imbalance will unlock the tremendous capacity, the tremendous potential within China's population. I mean, China has a lot of, just like in the United States, we have all these people living in our poor areas who we're treating like throwaways. What would it mean in the United States if everybody who's getting a terrible education in inner cities and elsewhere got a great education, had access to capital? It would significantly enhance our growth opportunities in the United States. And the same is true with China. If the people who are getting the short end of the stick were empowered with more access and more meaningful access, that could open up a lot of growth and a lot of potential in China. But the challenge in China is that the government and the party are so concerned about the expression of the will of Chinese people that they are investing enormously in keeping all of that pressure down. And we all know, for those of us who live in old buildings, what happens when you have your radiator and it gets too much steam. And we've all worked, China certainly has worked too hard to get here for any of us to want that kind of chaos and collapse. And everybody would want China to have a meaningful transition on both politically and economically. Again, not at once, over time. And therefore, this is my final point, is that China's greatest challenge is not economic reform. Ultimately, China's greatest challenge is political reform. And you can't have ultimately can mean a different range of time, but you can't have economic reform ultimately, sustainably, without political reform. And we'll know economic reforms are real and sustainable when they're underpinned by political reforms empowering China's population to hold its government accountable and allow true innovation and a knowledge economy to emerge. But until then, please count me among the skeptics. So I would love to hear your views. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter @AtlanticCouncil. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.